This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, when it comes to Chicago murders, only a fraction of cases are solved. Even fewer result in convictions. We'll hear the impact that has on the community. Advocates continue to call for reforming Illinois' parole system, which they say leaves some prisoners with little hope. New survey results from around the state show a strong majority backing the idea of tougher gun laws. We'll discuss that. We'll also hear about the first college program in Illinois to train workers for marijuana dispensaries. Also, it's known as the vine that ate the South, and it's headed to Illinois.
It's so dramatic. It's kind of like this big green monster. You know, it's like considered maybe the worst invasive species in the Southeast.
But finding more uses for the kudzu vine could be a key to controlling it. That story and more on Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear some more findings from a survey of Illinois voters. What do they have to say about issues like immigration, gun policies, and the media? Advocates for parole reform in Illinois continue their push. We'll hear more about that. And going to college to learn about marijuana. That and more this hour on Statewide. Data from the Chicago Police Department shows over the last 8 years, more than 4,000 people have been murdered in that city. Finding justice for the victims is an essential task for both police and prosecutors, but police solve only a small minority of the cases, and of those solved cases, only about 25% result in a conviction. Patrick Smith with member station WBEZ reports.
Chantal Malumba remembers everything about the morning her son was killed. She can't talk about it without weeping. It was 2 years ago. Her son, Darlis Colomoni, was 18. He was coming back from staying the night at a friend's house.
6:53, he called me. He said, I'm on my way home.
She remembers the street where she turned around on her way to work, terrified because of the way her son sounded on the phone.
It sounded like somebody, like he ran, like, no, I'm close to be home, soon. I said, no, Darlis, keep me, don't hang up.
Just a few minutes after that call, Darlis was shot to death in the far north side neighborhood of Rogers Park, less than a block from the apartment where he lived with his mother, sister, and grandma. Malumba remembers the police coming to give her the news later that day.
I see police with white shirts, like four, they ring the bell. And then I checked the window. I said, the police said, my son is gone. I think they shot my son. And then, since that time, my life changed forever.
The day after her son's funeral, Malumba says detectives called her down to the station and told her they'd identified the man who killed her son. She says they also played her a video that they said showed the moments leading up to her son's death. Malumba says while the video played, a detective pointed out to her that her son had a gun in a park near their home, that he and another person shot at each other but didn't hit anyone, and that then a man who did not look like he was involved in the initial shooting came out of a nearby apartment building and took off running after Darlis.
I see in the video, this is that person, you go, you shoot your son.
Darlis was killed about 5 blocks away. News reports from the day of the shooting quote neighbors describing Darlis being chased from behind and shot in the head. Darlis' death is one of the small minority of murder cases actually solved by Chicago police, but the man who killed Darlis was not charged with a crime. A police source says detectives presented the case to prosecutors who rejected charges, citing the fact that the suspect claimed self-defense and there were no witnesses to contradict him. A spokeswoman for Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox says prosecutors reviewed the incident and concluded that based on the evidence and the law, they could not meet their burden of proof to file criminal charges.
Darlis ran, EI, and then the person follow my son to shoot my son. It doesn't make any sense to me.
To Malumba, the video did not show Darlis with a gun or Darlis shooting. But she says even if he did do that, he should have been arrested and punished for it, not executed on the street. Detectives told Malumba her son's case was closed.
When I say, like, why you gonna close my son's case? They kill my son like an animal. And then he said, your son, he was one to kill somebody too like an animal. But for me, I said, okay, it means camera is there, and then they can come arrest my son. Then shoot my son.
Chicago police solved just 25% of the murders in 2017. Darlis' murder is one of those solved cases. But it's also one of 281 homicides over the last 8 years in which Chicago police say they've identified the killer, but Cook County prosecutors declined to file charges and no one was held accountable.
We are bringing charges on cases that we believe we can meet our burden on in court.
Risa Lanier is in charge of the Cook County State's Attorney's Criminal Prosecutions Bureau.
There are two requirements. First, we have to believe that we have the right person. Secondly, there has to be enough evidence. If those two requirements are not met, then we will have to reject the case ethically.
Prosecutors declined to bring charges in about one in every five murder cases brought to them by Chicago police over the most recent 8 years. That includes cases that were rejected outright and cases that prosecutors kicked back for further investigation, and at least so far, no charges have been filed. This isn't a new issue. Dick Devine is in private practice now, but he was Cook County's top prosecutor for a dozen years, from 1996 to 2008. He says the number of homicide cases rejected or sent back for further investigation seems similar to the ratio when he was in charge. And he says prosecutors have a really high bar for charging murder cases.
There are lots of reasons potential murder cases get that extra level of scrutiny. Number one, the penalties are so severe. And plus, number two, I think there's a recognition on the part of both police and prosecutors that, you know, the families of victims have gone through so much and have suffered such a tremendous loss that you want to be sure.
Devine says homicide cases are handled by the best and most experienced detectives and prosecutors, all driven to get justice for victims. But he suggests police can feel pressure to close murders and move on.
Detectives in a city like Chicago, they have a caseload that they have to deal with, and they want to do what's necessary and then pass it on to the prosecutors. The prosecutors want a stronger, better case, understanding that once they get the case as prosecutors, it's difficult to beef it up too much.
Lanier says police do a good job, but
there's a legal standard that we are trying to meet, and that's the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, as opposed to just arresting someone, which is a probable cause standard.
Do you see the difficulty for a family of a loved one who the police say they've solved the case and it's brought to prosecutors and it's rejected, and now for CPD that case is closed, and for you guys it's not a case at all, and they're left in this sort of position where there's just no hope for them?
I think it's important to understand that the work that we do on the legal side is one thing. It does not mean that we don't have compassion or sympathy for those victims. And we owe it to those family members to explain why, in this particular situation, your closure will not come through the criminal justice system.
The cases that are not charged, when you combine them with all of the unsolved cases, it means that for about three quarters of Chicago murders, there will likely never be any justice. To be clear, the biggest reason is the Chicago Police Department's dismal record solving murders. Police officials refused interviews for the story and responded to a list of questions with a one-sentence statement, saying the department is committed to conducting thorough investigations. But it's clear from the department's own data that the vast majority of cases never make it to prosecutors at all. Police have only made an arrest in about a third of the murders between 2011 and 2018. The death of Darlis Colomoni is one case that Chicago police did solve. His mom, Chantal Malumba, still can't believe his killer was never charged. Malumba wants justice for her son. But she also says his killer should have been charged with a crime because he is a danger to the public.
He leave there out at 7 in the morning, get the gun to go to follow my son, to chase my son, to kill my son.
Whatever her son may have been or done, Malumba says it makes the city less safe to leave a man on the streets who is willing to chase down a teenager and shoot him to death at 7 in the morning. Patrick Smith, WBEZ News.
Illinois residents across the state and across party lines largely support more gun regulations. That's according to the results of an NPR Illinois University of Illinois Springfield survey. And reporter Sam Dunklaw took a look at the new data.
Gun violence has touched all areas of the country, including here in Illinois. You might remember the mass shooting that happened here in February.
The horror playing out in Aurora, Illinois late today, a gunman opening fire, hitting several officers and workers, the shooting inside a factory warehouse quickly turning deadly.
Five people were killed and five officers were wounded, the gunman also dead.
45-year-old Gary Martin brought a 40 caliber handgun to work and started shooting after he was fired.
The Aurora tragedy, combined with high-profile shootings in other states, reopened the gun debate in Illinois. There have been renewed calls for more statewide firearm restrictions, but nothing major became law this year. So when researchers polled likely Illinois voters for this latest survey, they asked about specific ideas state lawmakers are considering.
Do you support or oppose requiring mental health background checks on all firearm purchases? Another question that we ask is about fingerprinting when it comes to the FOID card. We also ask about the banning of so-called assault weapons. And we also added in questions about so-called high-capacity magazines.
That's A.J. Simmons. He's head of the survey research office at UIS, which conducted the survey. The results show 92% of Illinoisans support requiring a mental health background check for gun buyers. That's about the same number as a similar survey from last year. Another 74% back the idea of banning what are commonly referred to as assault weapons, a big jump from 2018. While there is a partisan split on that question, a majority of both Democrats and Republicans are in favor. Meanwhile, 88% support requiring fingerprints to get a firearm owner's identification card, and 3 out of 4 Illinoisans favor banning magazines with more than 10 rounds. But while the numbers show broad support, the gun debate still sparks passions on both sides.
Illinois gun owners marching by!
Illinois gun owners marching by!
We're gonna keep our powder dry!
We're gonna keep our powder dry!
Those are some of the voices from an annual gun owners rally earlier this year in Springfield, which happened not long after the Aurora shooting. Many gun owners say that increased regulation unfairly targets them. Stephen Stewart runs a gun shop and shooting range in Bloomington.
It's just sad what's kind of happening here, how we're being victimized and demonized for, you know, wanting to be a gun owner.
However, Elisa Schemmel with Moms Demand Action, a group that's advocating for more state gun regulations, sees it differently.
If you are a responsible gun owner, you can still have a gun. There's no one's trying to take any guns away. They're just trying to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have them.
As in many states, Illinois also has plenty of people who lobby on behalf of gun owners to fight changes that could make it harder to purchase a firearm. Richard Pearson of the Illinois State Rifle Association is one of those people. He says Illinois already has some of the strictest requirements in the country, which includes scanning a person's mental health history.
We also have to have a background check. No matter who we sell a gun to, whether it's at a gun show, not at a gun show, our neighbor, our uncle, or through a dealer. So we're very tight in Illinois.
Of the more than 1,000 people polled for the NPR Illinois UIS survey, over a quarter of those identified as being gun owners, which is in line with Illinois census data. And even a majority of gun owners say they support all of the proposals. That includes those who are located downstate, where gun rights are often a campaign issue. Now, a single survey is unlikely to result in major change at the state level. Just ask A.J. Simmons.
Just because we see high levels of support from folks when it comes to these policies doesn't necessarily mean we'll see action.
But it's likely those pushing for more gun control, like suburban Democratic Representative Kathleen Willis of Addison, will point to the results.
I don't think it's a mandate. I think what it does is it reaffirms my conviction to continue going forward.
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
And Sam joins us now to discuss a couple of the other results from that NPR Illinois University of Illinois Springfield survey. When it comes to immigration, Illinois voters were asked how they feel about the state's nearly 2 million immigrants. Researchers framed that question like this: given the state's immigrant population, a portion of which is undocumented, do you believe immigrants help Illinois or hurt it? So, Sam, how did people respond?
Well, it was interesting, Sean. Folks responded like this. 59% overall say immigrants help Illinois, so that's roughly about 60, while 41% say they hurt. And the demographics split up to probably what you would imagine. Most younger folks believe immigrants help Illinoisans, and older folks are more inclined to say that they don't. Downstate folks were more willing to say that immigrants hurt Illinois, and those that are up in the Chicago region more likely to say that immigrants help.
Those people were also asked if immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children, often known as dreamers, should they get to stay. What were the results on that question? Did anything surprise you?
Well, what was surprising is that, you know, again, 60% of Illinoisans on that last question said that immigrants help, 40% say they don't. Now, when you're asking that specific question about dreamers, 73% of folks, and again, these are folks from Chicago all the way down through to southern Illinois, support keeping dreamers in the United States. It's interesting that when you're talking about immigrants as a large population, undocumented folks are a little bit more inclined to say that they don't necessarily help the population. But if you're talking about dreamers specifically, folks are a little more sympathetic. That was a little surprising to me.
Something else that's been quite divisive has been the issue of the media, the job the media does. Trust in the media has been a national topic for some time, and researchers who conducted the survey localized the issue here to Illinois, and they asked the more than 1,000 people who participated if they trust Illinois media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. And what were the results?
Well, once again, similar to what we sort of saw with the immigrant question, 59% of folks said that Illinois media cover the news fairly and accurately. 41% said no on that question. And again, it's a similar split. Republicans more likely to say the news isn't reported fairly, and the Democrats, 73% of them said, well, actually, the media around the state do cover things rather fairly.
Well, in nearly the same breath, researchers also asked people to rank how important local media is to them. And anything jump out at you about those responses?
Again, similar thing of what happened with the immigrant population. You know, when that specific question was asked, do you find local media to be important? We're talking local newspapers, radio stations, TV, similar to what we've got going on here. 83% of people said local media is important to me. That's where I get my news. So again, that was a little bit surprising to me. When you're asking about the issue of fairness, of accuracy, of balance, that's a little bit more divided of a question. But if you're saying whether or not local media is important, more folks are inclined to say yes to that.
That's Sam Dunklaw, and we have a lot more of that survey to read. You can find the full link to the NPR Illinois and University of Illinois Springfield survey at our website at statewideshow.com. Just ahead here on Statewide, a documentary asks if prison rehabilitation is a right. We'll have that story and more on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A push for parole reform in the state of Illinois. We'll hear about that. And later, the new marijuana law in the state will create jobs in the industry. We'll visit a college that's training people to work in dispensaries. But next, a story about second chances and making the most of a situation. Earlier this year, Dusty Rhodes traveled to Stateville Correctional Center at Joliet to learn how some inmates are getting college degrees while behind bars.
Roderick Zavala grew up in Chicago at 21st and State Street, the northern tip of a four-mile corridor lined with 8,000 units of public housing. His mom worked three jobs, including one at Walgreens, where she would pick up the Disney and Hanna-Barbera books that inspired Zavala to fall in love with reading. That passion could have made him a successful student, but on Chicago's South Side in the 1980s, it was hard to find a safe place to go to school.
My mother was always trying to get me out of the neighborhood I grew up in, so we constantly moved a lot. I was never in a school longer than a year. So you take me from one neighborhood to another school. To her, the school seems like a better place to go, but there still is a neighborhood around it that I have to operate in. So I continue to get in trouble in school and get kicked out of school. I don't blame anyone for my actions. Those were my actions. And I tell people now, I say, you know, if you raise a child in a war zone, that's all the child knows is war. But if you take that same child out of that war zone and you introduce him to people with new ideas and new things and you allow that child to flourish, then you have a completely different person.
Zavala has finally found a place to learn new ideas and flourish. Ironically, it's inside Stateville Correctional Center, a maximum security prison near Joliet, where Zavala is about halfway through a 40-year sentence. Despite dropping out of school at age 15, he's on the path to earning a master's degree through North Park University. Michelle Clifton Soderstrom directs the program.
So we started piloting classes about 4 years ago because, well, for me, I was teaching social ethics and getting frustrated with just teaching topics that weren't actually making change on the ground. So we decided that teaching in prison would be a great place.
North Park is a private college founded by the Evangelical Covenant Church. There are other church-sponsored prison education programs in other states, but three things set this one apart. For starters, it offers an accredited degree. North Park obtained waivers to offer a Master's of Art in Christian Ministry with an emphasis in restorative justice. And because it's a rigorous four-year program, they can accept students who don't have a bachelor's degree. You don't have to be a felon to get this deal. North Park also accepts a few students from the free world into this program. I met one of them.
I'm at North Park University, but I take my classes in prison.
That's Vicky Reddy. As you might notice from her accent, she's originally from Australia. Her work with the organization World Relief has taken her to refugee camps in the Middle East and ICE detention centers on the U.S. border. But at age 43, she still hasn't earned a degree. So now she spends 2 days a week inside Stateville.
This is a community that I could not have anywhere else. And it's teaching me something that I can't learn anywhere else. And so that part of it is equally as important as the piece of paper.
The third thing that sets this program apart is that it's not another vocational trade school for short-timers. To be eligible to apply for the North Park program, inmates have to have a full year of clean behavior, plus at least 15 years left on their sentence. Rich Stempinski, who manages adult education for the Illinois Department of Corrections, points to data from Angola, Louisiana's notorious state penitentiary, that show a somewhat similar program drastically reduced violent incidents there.
It gives guys who maybe not have had any hope something that motivates them, that's positive, that's rewarding for them. And the hope then is that they will have those discussions with their peers and be able to change the culture of Stateville.
Listening to Zavala, you get a feeling that culture shift might be happening already.
You know, education changes you. There is no possible way you can sit down and read and study and do papers and do research and not be changed. Because when you come up out of that, you've gained so much that you just want to share it. So you start to look around for people to share it with. And if a person is not on what you own, you don't want to be around them. It instills in us a confident belief that we can reestablish who we are. That's monumental. It's life-changing.
Clifton Soderstrom says 90 men applied for the 40 slots available in the North Park program. Zavala was the only one made available for an interview because his classmates elected him to be their spokesman. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Stateville Calling is a documentary about parole reform and its effect on aging prisoners. The film follows an 84-year-old activist, Bill Ryan, as he works to pass legislation. Screenings have been taking place around the state, and reporter Dana Vollmer talked with the director and producer about the effort.
I'm Ben Kolak. I'm a documentary filmmaker with Scrappers Film Group in Chicago.
My name is Yana Kunichoff. I'm a education reporter for Chalk Beach, Chicago right now, and I'm also a documentary film producer.
So we started working maybe 6 years ago with an artist in Chicago, Maria Gaspar, and through her, we got introduced to Bill Ryan, who's been working on incarceration issues. The initial focus of the project was really on the struggle of aging inmates since the death penalty got, you know, the moratorium put on in Illinois, and really this whole notion of changing parole and moving from determinate sentencing back to indeterminate sentencing has come into the foreground as kind of a way to hopefully fix or improve our criminal justice system in Illinois. I don't know if you want to add more to that, Yana.
No, I mean, I think that also given the Trump presidency in the last couple of years, I think we're really interested in thinking about how change is made at the local level or the state level. And we felt that Illinois was a really interesting example of some of the work that a committed group of activists were able to do here around a criminal justice issue that seemed particularly intractable, which was getting rid of the death penalty. And Bill Ryan, who's a central character in our documentary, was a really big part of that. So I think taking some of those lessons and thinking about how they might apply to the system today was really interesting for us.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can contextualize that a little bit more.
more just for people who were maybe unfamiliar with the fact that we once had a parole system that ended in the 70s. We also put a moratorium on the death sentence. Ben did mention determinate sentencing, but just kind of how did we get to this point where you're not allowed to be sentenced to death, however, you can spend your entire life in prison with no chance of getting out? Can you touch on that a little bit?
The points that we're hitting are, as we see it, is that indeterminate sentencing, you know, where when somebody commits a crime, they're put in prison and then they appear before people to think about it. Are you rehabilitated? Are you no longer either a threat to society, or have you done your time and learned from it or whatnot? That really emerged after the Civil War in the United States, and it was really adopted across the whole country kind of in the latter half of the 19th century. And that was really the norm up until the 1970s, when a number of factors, actually most of which saw themselves as kind of liberal and progressive, said, you know, this indeterminate sentencing, it seems like every time somebody goes up before parole, and if they're rich or maybe if they're white, they get out right away. Versus if they're poorer, maybe if they're a person of color, it seems like they never get out, or it's not fair to them. So kind of along those lines, and coupled with kind of get tough on crime, Richard Nixon thinking in the 1970s, that's when we move to the determinant sentencing, which is the norm, you know, in a number of states like Illinois, California, a lot of New England, where it's just cut and dry. You get sentenced to a certain number of years. You got to stay there that long. With part of that shift, though, there's a number of people, a number of whom are featured in our film, who were sentenced when it was still indeterminate sentencing. But since we moved to determinate sentencing and everyone is afraid that perhaps if they get out on their watch and if something were to happen, that they would be held accountable, or the precedent that it would set, have now been kind of stuck in prison. Whereas if they would have been sentenced maybe during determinate sentencing, they might have gotten out by now, depending on the crime.
Yeah, I mean, I would also just say that this is where the issue of elderly prisoners come in. I think a lot of the people we speak about specifically, or speak to specifically, who were on death row and then their sentence was moved to life in prison without the possibility of parole, they're aging in prison. Elderly prisoners are also the least likely age group to reoffend. They're also the age group that it is most expensive to continue to incarcerate. So you kind of have this these policy issues, and then the very real reality of what it costs to keep elderly prisoners detained, and the really big burden that that places on the system at the same time as they're the least likely to reoffend. So that's some of the contradiction that we're hoping to address through this film.
So when we look at the issue of parole reform, who are the key players in it? Who is in support of it? Who's against it? And what are their arguments?
That's a good question. I think the subjects in the film would definitely be a lot better positioned to answer that. And I guess, you know, my first response would be to kind of let the film speak for itself. But, you know, in broad strokes, a lot of what we've encountered is that opponents to it often tend to be representatives of the state's attorney, who doesn't want to see these kind of existing sentences rolled back. Perhaps other people that are, their communities are in one way or another being supported or benefiting from the number of incarcerated people. So, you know, there's a lot of parts in the state of Illinois where the prison is one of the larger employers, and to see some kind of drop off in prisoners could potentially lead to a drop off of employment, which is certainly a pillar of some communities.
Yeah, and there is a piece of legislation that is kind of at the center of your film, which is this Pathway to Community legislation that's sponsored by Arthur Turner. I was wondering if you could kind of explain what that legislation is seeking to do.
Sure. Well, it's been in a number of manifestations, and I think even the one that we're following the film is no longer what Bill is kind of advocating for. He's always, you know, strategizing and looking to reframe things. But really at the heart of it is this notion of, as Yana was speaking to, that as elderly incarcerated folks, aging inmates, are the least likely to reoffend, and that by releasing them, the state could potentially save an enormous amount of money to do some kind of small test, you know, with a very select very well vetted group of incarcerated folks, probably largely who have been stuck there, you know, that were sentenced in the days of indeterminate sentencing, to put them in a supportive place and see how it works. And then to gather some data from that to see if it could be scaled up or improved, you know, as a way to make our criminal justice system more about really seeing these incarcerated folks as part of our community and people that we have a duty to support and take responsibility for, rather than just demonize, you know, which is, I think, largely what's been the way of thinking about them since the 70s.
So in making this film, you were able to speak with people who would be potentially able to get early release if a program like the one we just discussed were to pass, or another bill. Would you be able to just touch on some of the stories that you heard, and if there was one that really stood out to you?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the prisoners that I do think is a really good example of why parole would be important is named Janet Jackson. She has been incarcerated for over 3 decades for the murder of her husband. So Janet Jackson didn't actually physically murder her husband, but she contracted someone to kill him. And so because of that, she was held responsible for his death and is in prison for life. So she is someone who was abused by her husband. She's spoken a lot about being a survivor of domestic violence and the few tools that she had for getting out of that relationship or dealing with the trauma of that in any other way. But she talks about how she found some of that while incarcerated. But, you know, today she still faces life in prison. She has a series of health ailments, and at the same time, a lot of the rehabilitative services that she feels helped her get to this place where she was able to move past being a survivor of abuse are no longer available in the prison system because of cost. So I think she's an example of someone who actually has a really complicated story for why they were incarcerated. And I think in a lot of ways is sort of a model for what rehabilitation can look like. And she feels that she would be able to do a lot more good not behind bars.
One of the other people that Bill has had one of his longest relationships with is Ronaldo Hudson, who speaks very much to the very difficult upbringing where he witnessed, you know, multiple other family members get killed and kind of the impact that had on him, issues with substance abuse and how that led to the crime that got him incarcerated. And then subsequently, how he's had the time and space to reflect and distance himself, you know, from the kind of conditions that initially made him and led to him being a threat and committing that crime, and the kind of perspective he has now. And, you know, even while incarcerated, he's been such a contribution to society at large. He's been, over the years, one of the key contributors to the newspaper, Stateville Speaks, that Bill Ryan helped start, you know, finding an avenue through art making and just supporting his fellow incarcerated colleagues. And he's really the person that Bill often puts up as the prime example of how somebody can change while incarcerated and how it's foolish and immoral for us as a society to keep them locked up.
For people that do come out and view your film, what do you hope that they take away from it?
The kind of working slogan we have for the film Stateville Calling is rehabilitation a right? Because, you know, there's a number of rights we feel we have, right, as Americans that are stated explicitly. And whereas in some other kind of first world Western or developed countries, rehabilitation is seen as a right, that if you commit a crime, you have a right to get support, to reflect on and reenter society. It's not seen as something in our society, either explicitly or even implicitly. And I think the question is, should it be? You know, should our values, the same values that shape this country that many of us appeal to or reinforce every Sunday in church or however we kind of think about our morals, is that something that we all have a right to? And then if so, how do we ensure that from a public policy perspective? That's what I hope people take away from this, that they leave thinking about that issue and continuing to discuss it, because it's something incredibly important to maintaining our community and from a cost perspective as well, you know, with the amount of money going to prisons instead of schools, that I think, you know, really impacts every one of us as citizens.
Yana, is there anything you'd want to add to that?
I think I would just say that we have tried really hard to bring in kind of as wide of a range of voices as possible into this project. So we obviously talked to the people most affected by this themselves, incarcerated elderly folks. We talk to activists on the ground, but we also talk to people working with the state's attorney's office. We talk to victims groups and people who have themselves been kind of seen tragedy because of violence. And I think that that hopefully lays out kind of a really thorough series of arguments and considerations for what I think is a really complicated and emotional but really pressing issue.
That's Ben Kolak, who's the director, and Yana Kunichoff, the producer of Stateville Calling, and they spoke with Dana Vollmer. Earlier this year, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a law allowing young adults sentenced to lengthy prison terms for most crimes eligible for parole review after serving 10 years, and it marks the first time the state will be allowed to grant discretionary parole since the practice was abolished in 1978. However, many are still pushing to make that law retroactive to those already in the Illinois prison system. Next up on Statewide, college training for marijuana jobs. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead this hour, an invasive plant common in the South now finding its way toward Illinois, and a state university hoping to raise money from selling some property. That's all coming up on Statewide. This fall, a community college in Des Plaines started a new program to train students for jobs in marijuana dispensaries, the first of its kind in Illinois. It isn't the only school looking to create programs in the new industry, especially as recreational marijuana becomes legal in Illinois in just a couple of months. From member station WBEZ, Kate McGee explains.
Dr. Sarah Mann had just opened a medical marijuana clinic in the wealthy suburb of Barrington earlier this year when she decided her skills in this field could be useful to more than just her patients. So she reached out to Oakton Community College.
I believe I said something like, I'm a cannabis physician and I'm really interested in teaching, and I was wondering if you guys are putting a program together or something along those lines. And then that led me here to cannabis professor.
This fall, about 100 students at Oakton are enrolled in the program, where they're learning things like which strains of marijuana could help with various medical issues. That way, they can give advice and recommendations to customers. Classes meet at night. Earlier this week, students in one of the classes gave presentations on their research projects.
So first of all, I'm doing a paper about socialization of medical cannabis for the older population.
The topic that I decided or landed on was looking at the use of cannabinoids in dementia care.
It's a diverse group of students. Some already work in healthcare or are looking for a career change to work in a dispensary. There are younger students, too. Some are medical marijuana users themselves. Oakton Leadership hopes this program will better train people helping patients as they navigate their medical marijuana needs. Ilio Lott is the vice president of student affairs.
When I originally started talking to dispensary owners, they were telling me that what they were getting for employees were what they called weed enthusiasts. And we really wanted to provide a more educated and more patient-centered approach.
Oakton could see more community colleges jumping into this training arena on the medical or recreational side, which becomes legal January 1st. The new recreational marijuana law includes a pilot program for 8 community colleges to create careers in cannabis certificate programs. They won't just be allowed to teach about the cannabis industry.
The key component of the new law is it allows them to grow it on their campus.
That's Matt Berry with the Illinois Community College Board. Licensed community colleges will be able to grow up to 50 marijuana plants at any time. Now, doing so on campus would violate the Federal Drug-Free Schools and Campus Act and could put their federal financial aid at risk. It's likely they'll try to work around that issue by partnering with those who already grow marijuana or do training off-site. They could also use hemp or even tomato plants. And while state law is letting community colleges lead the way in training and education, some 4-year public universities in Illinois don't want to be left behind. Late last month, a couple hundred people gathered on a rainy Saturday morning at Chicago State University for a cannabis expo. Chicago State held the event to connect people in the neighboring Southside community with the industry. State Senator L.G. Sims was one of many black lawmakers who came to address the crowd.
You're either at the table or you are on the menu. We wanted to be at the table. We wanted to make sure that the communities that were ravaged by the war on drugs had the ability to benefit from the same.
Next week, classes start for Chicago State's own cannabis certificate program. It's not geared toward a specific job, but Chicago State leaders say it's an entry point for people. And those who work in the industry say any education is helpful. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
Illinois lawmakers are trying to find ways for universities to save money. At Northern Illinois University, that involves selling presidential property. Peter Medlin has the story.
About a mile away from NIU's campus in DeKalb, a nice two-story house on the corner of Woodlawn Drive is vacant. The only sign of wear in sight is on a small metal sign in the freshly cut yard where the address is slowly rusting away. Built in 1955, this house has been home to the presidents of NIU. But when Dr. Lisa Freeman was hired last year, she already had a home in DeKalb. And NIU trustees began to ask themselves, what do we do with this? Since the house was non-adjacent to campus, if they wanted to sell it, the money would have to go back to the state's general revenue fund. That's where State Representative Jeff Kiker came in. He introduced a bill to let NIU sell property off campus and keep the money for a specific purpose.
A lot of the details surrounding this bill actually go back to kind of the budget impasse and the amount of deferred maintenance that NIU had accumulated.
Matt Streb is the chief of staff to the president at NIU.
We have, by some measures, $500 million of deferred maintenance, right? Obviously, we're not going to cover the $500 million with the sale of that one house. But nonetheless, I mean, that money can be put to improve, you know, classrooms on campus, to help with roofs and a variety of other things that, you know, we desperately need.
So the president's house is going up for sale, along with several other properties owned by the school. John Heckman is in charge of facilities and campus services at NIU. He said the school still has to spend money on general upkeep of the house until it goes on the market in the spring.
So in the meantime, while it is empty, we still have to mow the grass and keep everything in good condition. We don't want it to deteriorate and then, you know, be ready to sell it and we got a leaking roof or something.
Another plan passed this year allows public universities and community colleges to sell off their surplus real estate and use the money for their deferred maintenance and emergency repairs. So in the future, will NIU be buying another presidential house? Matt Streb said,
I think it's possible they could look for another potential property, you know, maybe something closer to campus. You know, a lot of institutions are moving more to kind of a housing allowance or a housing stipend.
Lisa Freeman has no allowance, but the housing situations of university presidents across the state are very different. Jeff Kiker says it's a conversation worth having.
Is it needed? I mean, seriously, in this day and age, are you going to dictate to somebody where they should live just because they happen to be an executive at one of the state institutions? I don't think that's appropriate.
Eastern Illinois University doesn't have a presidential residence, but their president does receive an annual housing allowance of more than $30,000 on top of a $290,000 salary. For the Southern Illinois University system, neither of their chancellors nor the president currently have housing allowances in their contracts. They used to have a presidential house called the Stone Center, which is now used as an office for the system president. The University of Illinois system president lives in their 14,000-square-foot Georgian Revival-style home. The massive house has seen expensive repairs in the last two decades. The chancellor at the University of Illinois at Springfield has a housing allowance of $25,000. But the University of Illinois at Chicago's chancellor now forgoes his allowance to live in a university-owned home. Illinois State and Western Illinois both have a university residence. At Western, their house is also empty. They just appointed an interim president. He was hired to be a provost, so he'd already bought a house in Macomb. Darcy Schinberger is the executive director of communication at Western Illinois University.
Even though he and his family are not living at the home at this time, it is still being used for university events and functions. In fact, last week, Dr. Abraham did host a reception at the residence.
University officials haven't decided if the interim president will receive a housing allowance or if he'll eventually move into the residence. Illinois also passed a major infrastructure plan that includes some money for the billions of dollars in delayed maintenance for universities across the state. I'm Peter Medlin.
The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign Committee published this week some recommended changes to how the school handles claims of sexual misconduct against faculty. Rachel Otwell has more.
The recommendations include broadening the campus's definition of sexual harassment and overhauling discipline procedures. Robin Carr, UIUC law professor, chaired the committee.
We haven't always done the best job.
and we need to do better. I took it as my task to create a system of policies and procedures that can take us into a new era.
The report comes after a year of scrutiny of the university's handling of several cases of harassment allegations against professors. In NPR Illinois and ProPublica investigation uncovered three cases where professors accused of misconduct were found in violation of campus policy. One stayed on faculty, the two others resigned quietly after periods of paid leave and went on to new out-of-state positions. Campus leadership says it will convene another committee charged with refining and implementing the new recommendations. I'm Rachel Otwell.
Starved Rock State Park's one of the most popular tourist destinations in the state, and it can be a bit too popular at times. The number of visitors going there can lead to traffic delays and warnings issued on busy weekends that people might have to be turned away until more parking is available. Northern Illinois University's Center for Governmental Studies recently completed a report on ways to address crowds. The center looked at how different state and national parks have tackled the issue. Some measures include charging an entry fee and adding a reservation system to spread out visits. Researcher Mim Evans says it's a complex issue.
Rather than a quick fix solution for just Starved Rock, it may be wise to step back and look at the big picture and where we want our state parks to fall within the overall state planning effort.
The report also recommends making improvements to the park, including new types of attractions like zip lines and water parks. State officials added nearly 2,700 acres to the park last year, and at this point, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources says it will use the report to guide its next moves. Well, the invasive perennial vine kudzu has long been a scourge of southern U.S. landscapes and is now being seen in the Midwest. One permaculture collective is investing in new ways to use rather than simply erase the stubborn plant. Josephine McRobbie has this report.
Kudzu, the East Asian vine, was introduced to the U.S. as an ornamental and erosion control plant in the late 1800s. But now,
you know, it's like considered maybe the worst invasive species in the Southeast.
The so-called vine that ate the South can grow a foot a day, covering whole trees, fields, and telephone poles. It's beginning to expand to landscapes as far-flung as Illinois, New Jersey, and Oregon. Kudzu is the target of huge numbers of eradication projects, but despite this, many Southerners are captivated by the plant's power. It's inspired folk songs, poems, and books, as well as advocates.
Kudzu was one of the first plants that really captured my imagination because it's so dramatic. It's kind of like this big green monster.
Justin Holt is an ecology educator and permaculturist in Asheville, North Carolina. With Zev Friedman and Lauren Bacchus, he runs the collective Kudzu Culture, which aims to raise awareness about the many uses of kudzu. It's a fertilizer for soil and fodder for livestock and can also be processed to make foods, fibers, and herbal medicines.
It's like a staple of cultures and industries in parts of the world where people have developed relationships with the plant.
It's a challenge that is central to permaculture. How do we co-evolve with our environment? Studies have shown that kudzu thrives with rising temperatures, and so with a changing climate.
This is a plant that is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Kudzu Culture runs regular camps for those who are interested in the plant. Depending on the season, they dig the roots, harvest the vines, and then process the kudzu using traditional Japanese methods.
That is, I don't think, very scalable in like today's modern industrial economy in the Southeast. So we're trying to figure out ways to move away from like the processing that's dependent on a lot of hand labor.
So at a recent research and development camp, they experimented with using a food grade cement mixer to clean off the roots and a chipper shredder to process chunks of roots into mash. Next, the mash went into pillowcases and into the wash.
We just like ran a cycle through the washing machine and caught the water that came out.
This kudzu water can be used in a couple of ways. It's sort of a cold extract tea, one that Kudzu Culture has sold to local kombucha companies as an ingredient. But it can also be settled and then refined to make a chalky white starch.
In the cold water, I'm going to add it to this as it's simmering.
Holt is stirring up the base of some silky tofu, made only with starch powder, peanut butter, salt, and water.
Very, very thick paste because I've got a lot of kudzu starch in here.
The Kudzu Culture Trio source recipe ideas from all kinds of places. old Southern recipe books, kudzu Instagram hashtags, and East Asian cooking blogs that they run through Google Translate. You can eat the kudzu leaves alone. They're similar in taste to pea shoots. The starch can be used to make a turmeric golden milk or a mochi ice cream. And one of the few traditional uses in the South is using the flowers of the vine to make jelly.
And they'd use that because the smell of the flowers is like, it's like the color purple, smells like purple, like grape markers or something.
Despite kudzu's reputation and negative qualities, Holt and his colleagues think its possibilities can be leveraged and the plant can truly be integrated into farm and food economies. They're documenting their methodology and starting to apply for grants. They're looking at ideas like how to become a buyer of the roots dug up by farmers, or how to process starch or weaving fiber more efficiently.
And that's kind of like the main driver behind what we're doing, is asking that question, like how can this really scale up? How can harvesting kudzu as a means of control, as a means of providing food and medicine in a resilient way to people, how can that really take off beyond, you know, some crazy permaculturists who think it's a cool thing to do?
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Josephine McRobbie.
That wraps up this week's Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Tune in next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Our website is statewideshow.com. All of our episodes can be found there with links to the stories you hear each week. Also, our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.